Part 5. Earth. Swedish Rock. At the beginning of my chemical odyssey, I had traced a map of the world and placed a dot on it wherever one of the elements had been discovered. A very curious map it turned out to be. Aside from zinc and platinum, which were found without the assistance of Western science in India and the Americas respectively, all the dots relating to the naturally occurring elements fell in Europe. A cluster of dots in Berkeley, California, accounted for most of the elements heavier than uranium that had been made artificially following the discovery of nuclear fission. Another cluster at Dubna, north of Moscow, showed where some more recent radioactive elements have been synthesized. Europe showed four major hotspots of earlier date. London, boosted by the multiple successes of Davy and Ramsay, and Paris could claim just over a dozen elements apiece. Berlin, Geneva, and Edinburgh also made their mark. But the two largest clusters of dots after Paris and London were both in Sweden, one at the old university city of Uppsala, and the other in the capital, Stockholm. Swedish science could claim the discovery of at least 19 elements, more than a fifth of the naturally occurring total. Many of them, indeed, celebrate the places where they were found. Yttrium, erbium, terbium, and ytterbium, named after the ore mine at Ytterby. Holmium, named after Stockholm itself, or after more or less romantic ideas of Scandinavia. Scandium, thallium. In old Europe, it is quite often the case that the elements are named for places associated with their discovery. For instance, strontium happens to be the only element named after a place in the British Isles. Strontian, in Scotland. It's more often the other way round in the United States, where chemical knowledge helpfully preceded westward expansion and the rush to uncover the riches of the wilderness. America's golden hills and silver lakes were no idle poetic illusion. They expressed a direct connection to the earth into which adventurers hammered their tent pegs, and the hope, whether fulfilled or ultimately dashed, that these precious metals were to be found there. Aside from gold and silver, a dozen elements appear nakedly in town names, from the expected irons in Missouri and Utah, Leadville in Colorado and Copper Center, Alaska, to the frankly surprising sulfur, Oklahoma, cobalt, Idaho, antimony, Utah, and boron, California. What made Sweden figure so largely in the story of the elements? I have been concerned throughout this book to suggest that we are familiar with many of the elements in a cultural way, that is to say, without ever stepping into a laboratory. We know neon and sodium for the light they cast, iodine for its brown balm, chromium for its cheap shine. Others, such as sulfur, arsenic, and plutonium, we tend to know more by reputation. The Swedish finds are mostly obscure by these measures. They include metals such as manganese and molybdenum, and a good handful of the elements known collectively as the rare earths, a group that includes all of those elements directly named after Swedish locations. They have not made a mark in the sense that they have become a byword for some human horror or delight. Yet these elements, too, have a cultural connection, and, as their toponymy implies, it is a connection that runs deep. Paris and London revealed new elements to the world because they were major centers of intellectual life. Berkeley and Dubna happened to be the sites chosen for the specialist machines needed to manufacture the heavier elements beyond uranium in the periodic table. But in Sweden's case, the logic is unshiftable. Her elements sprang from the very ground of the country. In order to learn more about this fertile womb of the elements, and how it was that there were men of science ready there to act as midwives, I decided to visit Sweden myself in order to find out how it was that two cities on the margins of Europe, one scarcely more than a small town, sustained an advantage over a period of a century and a half that enabled them to outstrip London and Paris in this race of discovery. During the first half of the 17th century, Sweden briefly became the new superpower of Northern Europe, overrunning Norway, Finland, and parts of Russia, Northern Germany, and the area now occupied by the Baltic states. Underwriting the expansion was Sweden's vast reserves of iron and copper ore, which provided the necessary military and economic might. In time, these imperial ambitions were superseded by a new and more attractive idea, that of Scandinavia. But the mining continued, and it was from these mines, during the years of Sweden's gentle decline, that this one nation made its lavish contribution to the periodic table. I muse on this history and how it is reflected in the Swedish elements, whose names became gradually less localized with each successive discovery, from yttrium in 1794 to scandium in 1879, as my plane flies over lakes and forests toward Stockholm. In Stockholm, I meet Hjalmar Fors, a young historian of chemistry with a wispy blonde beard, who has agreed to lead me on a walking tour of the scientific sites. We start in the Stortinget. It means big square, although it is a little square on the little island of Stadsholmen, Stockholm's old town. Commanding one short side of the square is a red-washed merchant's house with Baroque gables and a psalm inscribed on a tablet above the door. It is where Carl Scheler, the nearly man of oxygen and chlorine, worked as a pharmacist around 1768. Our next stop is the National Mint, which stands on the waterside hard by the Royal Palace. Here, in 1735, Georg Brandt, the guardian of the mint, speculated that the blue color of the smelt ore obtained as a byproduct from the royal copper mines might be the clue to a new element. The Board of Mines based at the Mint was responsible for the analysis of minerals and maintained the first chemical laboratory in Sweden long before there was one at the university in Uppsala or anywhere else. This laboratory had been around for long enough to have fallen into some decay when Brandt came on the scene and set about modernizing it. It seems that Brandt may not have been thanked for this labor, however. Brandt was a rationalist, but his masters were Rosicrucians, disinclined to let go of their mystical beliefs. In time, however, Brandt gained greater control over operations and was able to exert a more enlightened influence. During the latter part of his career, he continued to devote much energy to disproving charlatans' claims to have transmuted silver and other metals into gold. It took him 7 years to obtain the first specimen of cobalt metal. It was, Hjalmar tells me, the first truly modern discovery of a chemical element, that is to say, the first to be supported by a solid notion of chemical theory, not merely alchemical hocus-pocus. We move on, crossing over the water to Karl XII Square. Among the grand buildings overlooking the greenery is a substantial 19th-century yellow ochre edifice that was the headquarters of the iron mines, when Sweden was the world's greatest exporter of the metal. An extended bas-relief frieze runs around the top of the building. It shows heroic figures engaged in every stage of the iron-making process, from extracting the ore, to smelting in the furnace, to casting the pigs. Lower down, the facade is punctuated by plaster medallions of Scheler, Berzelius, and other great Swedish chemists. "I rather like this," says Hjalmar with a glint in his eye. "Nobody really knows who these guys are now. But there they still are, up on the wall." I am beginning to sense the vital connection not only between national prosperity and mining, but also between mining and chemical science. Sweden's first true chemists were kept in employment one way or another by mining interests. Unlike their peers in Britain and France, they tended to be highly trained in the analysis of minerals. They worked at the Royal Mint or the Board of Mines or in direct collaboration with mine owners. They obtained their specimens from the mines and were frequent visitors themselves to the mines at Fallon and Västmanland, a day or two's ride from Stockholm or Uppsala. Here they were doubtless to be seen scrabbling through the tailings for exceptional stones, or searching the exposed veins for glimmers of unusual color, often performing their preliminary analyses in makeshift laboratories set up on site. These were no aristocrats amusing themselves in plush home laboratories, but realists aware that wealth came by virtue of hard labor out of the cold earth, and that any scientific knowledge gained in addition to that would be the more meritorious if it led to an increase in that wealth. And these men were justly rewarded for their realism by the business community whom they served. No medallions of Lavoisier or Cavendish are to be found on the commodity exchanges of Paris and London. We stop for a beer at a café in the Royal Hop Garden Public Park, with Scheler's unreliable statue gazing down on us. Hjalmar tells me of his pipe dream to rewrite the history of science by shifting the center of gravity eastward to focus on the intellectual traffic across the Baltic, between the Scandinavian, German, and Russian powers, ignoring for a change the bickering rivalry of the English and the French. It is a project that could restore to their rightful place in the chemical pantheon the shrinking violets of Sweden's mining laboratories, men whose congenital modesty led them fatally to delay publication of their discoveries, or even to shun it altogether, so helping to ensure they never receive their due on the world stage. Johan Garn, the discoverer of manganese. Tobern Bergman, the eminence grise behind many of the metals first isolated from Swedish sources, but the direct discoverer of none. And Scheele, who, having moved on from Stockholm, found even Uppsala too exciting, and spent the years when he might have been famous holed up in the little Västmanland town of Köping, batting away offers of employment from wealthy English and German patrons. The next day I take the train to Uppsala. Stockholm was the commercial and financial center where the metals from upcountry were assayed, traded, and made into coin. What was Uppsala's role? Uppsala has the oldest university in Scandinavia, established in 1477, but it wears its history lightly. The place hardly seems like an intellectual hothouse. There is life on its few shopping streets, but no real bustle. Pedestrians and bikes weave happily around each other, and cars are few. It is easy to picture the city as it must have been two or three centuries ago. A fast-flowing river and a granite channel divides town from Gaon. But students are as thin on the ground as the shoppers. I meet Anders Lundgren, a lecturer in the history of science at the university, who sports a tangle of grey beard on a scale that Hallmar Fors can only aspire to. As we stroll along, I observe idly what an extraordinarily genial place Uppsala seems to be. Yes, it is, Anders agrees. Now, but not in the winter. It is early June. He points out a white dormered building where in the mid-18th century, Uppsala's first professors of chemistry, Johan Wallerius and Tobern Bergman, made their laboratories. It was in this building and its successors that most of Sweden's element discoverers either learnt their art or passed it on as professors to the next generation. This was the case whether they came from Stockholm, like Anders Ekberg, tantalum, and Per Cleve, holmium and thulium, or from the mining country like Brent, cobalt, or even from the Finnish territories like Johan Gadolin, yttrium. They all spent time in Uppsala. Peter Helm, molybdenum, and Lars Nielsen, scandium, were two more Uppsala graduates. Scheele, meanwhile, ran the pharmacy in the town square where he made the first chlorine and oxygen, although he played no official part in academic life. Uppsala has a splendid university museum, the onion-domed Gustavianum. But in what I am coming to accept as the inevitable Swedish fashion, it omits to celebrate even one of these men. Equidistant from Stockholm and the mines, Uppsala was the third point of a triangle, the thinking brain to the laboring hand and the pumping heart of the Swedish body politic. It was not a straightforward relationship, however. The crown needed the mines to fund its imperial ambitions, and the mine owners no doubt enjoyed the royal patronage. But it is not immediately clear why either of them needed the scientists. Anders Lundgren has studied the way mining influenced the development of science in Sweden. Chemistry could never pay back to mining, he explains. The miners had no need of chemists to point out the valuable ores to them, and may well have resented these secular intruders with their blithe unconcern for the miners' obscure traditions. And if the chemists were lucky enough to discover new elements, then these were of no interest either. They might fill odd gaps in theoretical understanding. But theories of chemical affinity were no use in a blast furnace. Yet the chemists did gain support, such that for a long time in Sweden, chemistry was probably the only science to offer the prospect of a decent career. The crown gained intellectual prestige from supporting the laboratory at the Board of Mines, and mine owners emulated this largesse on their own modest scale. Some mine owners, indeed, such as Berzelius's patron and collaborator Wilhelm Hisinger, were scholars in their own right. The national minography that Hisinger produced at the age of 24, for example, a kind of atlas of mineral resources, was less the stake-claiming project of an avaricious prospector, far more a product of humanistic pleasure in knowledge for its own sake. Though it may do little to commemorate them, the Gustavianum did contain one further clue to the extraordinary success of Sweden's chemists. I have indicated elsewhere that the discovery of elements often relies on the possession of some special technology, and that given this device or that technique, the discoveries then often come in a rush. It is easy to believe that in the 18th century, there was no such technology in place to assist in prizing the rare earths and other elements from the grudging Swedish rock. This is so in the sense that no high-powered gadget suddenly unlocked the floodgates, and the discoveries came instead in painful fits and starts over a long period. Yet during all this time, there was one tool which no self-respecting Swedish chemist was ever without: his blowpipe. The specimen in the museum is perhaps 20 centimeters in length and appears to be made of iron. It is essentially a thin, elegantly tapered tube, not unlike a cigarette holder. At one end it is slightly flared, so as to produce a good seal in the user's mouth. At the other, the airway is bent through 90 degrees and forced through a small hole, while a separate outlet drains off spittle, as in a musical wind instrument. This simplest of equipment was the key to the analysis of unfamiliar minerals. It had the great advantage that it could be used in the field. According to a guide published by one distinguished Swedish mineralogist, it amounted to nothing less than a pocket laboratory. Even Goethe, a keen scientific amateur, had Berzelius instruct him in its use. The blowpipe was eventually superseded by the spectroscope, but it remained a feature of analytical chemistry teaching until the middle of the 20th century. Anders Lundgren remembers trying one out at school and describes to me how it works. Though simple enough, it demands powerful lungs and fiendish skill if it is to deliver good results. Its great versatility lies in the fact that it may be used to blow a jet of air through different regions of a flame, thereby producing a high-temperature zone that is able either to oxidize or to reduce, the reverse chemical process, a mineral sample positioned in the way. If all the senses are alert, a vast range of diagnostic information may follow from this apparently crude process. If the user has the breath to sustain the flow of air for 10 or 15 minutes to allow the sampled mineral to come to red heat, the color of the flame may change repeatedly as different metallic elements are vaporized from it. The reason why the airway is bent is so that the user gets a clear view to the point where the flame strikes the mineral. The smell of the vapors can confirm the presence of non-metal ingredients, such as sulfur, selenium, and tellurium. Even the sound the mineral makes may be significant, with a crackling noise, for example, being characteristic of chemically bound water being freed from the sample. The blowpipe seems to me to express the essence of what Anders describes to me as Sweden's characteristically boring good chemistry. Even the scientists may have been bored at times, sweating and puffing in frustration over unreadable minerals, dissolving them up to produce an endless succession of almost indistinguishable salts. It is a world that seems far from the miraculous gold and copper, amber and jewels, that scintillate through the mythology of this land. I wonder what colorful flames of hope must have danced at the back of their minds as these men performed their inexorable experiments. This was science of the green-fingered kind that relies on craftsmanlike skill, immense patience, and intimate familiarity with its raw materials. It was these qualities, more than mercurial brilliance or extravagant equipment, that explained the discovery of so many of the elements in this northeastern extremity of the European continent. These qualities, and of course, the prodigal abundance of the soil. Europium Union. The rare earths are not rare, but they are unsung. This group of elements to which so many of the Swedish discoveries belong populates a row of the periodic table, which is usually shown dangling below the rest of the table like a vacancies notice slung below a motel sign. Its members are scandium, yttrium, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, europium, gadolinium, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, thallium, ytterbium, and lutetium. And, rare though they are not, you can be easily forgiven for never having heard of a single one of them. Nor are they really gritty earths. All are middleweight metals. It is only because they for so long resisted extraction from their oxide ores that they earned this general label. Recalcitrance may be the rare earth's main unifying characteristic. In other respects, their properties are finely differentiated. Indeed, it is a matter of chemical semantics as to whether some of them, scandium and yttrium at the beginning of the sequence, and lutetium at the end, even belong on the list at all. In almost every case, the isolation of the rare earths, from yttrium in 1794 to promethium in 1945, was a punishing grind. These discoveries do have the distinction, however, that they were made, apart from the anomalous radioactive promethium, by thoroughgoing chemists. They were not dependent upon some unique technology closer to physics, as was the case with some other groups of elements. The alkali metals discovered electrolytically by Davy, Ramsay's inert gases glowing in their discharge tubes, the transuranium elements thrown together in the Berkeley particle accelerator. The separation of the rare earths was chemistry's all the way. The typical procedure was to dissolve an ore in acid to form a solution containing a mixture of salts. This was then slowly evaporated so that the salt of each element crystallized out in turn, while the overlying liquid retained others in solution. Careful repetition of this process, sometimes thousands of times, enabled chemists eventually to separate these very similar substances one from another, and from them, then to isolate the new elements at their heart. It was, as one chemical historian dryly remarks, an enormous undertaking which would have difficulty attracting grant support today. Monotonous as it undoubtedly was, this long-running project was heaven to a particular type of experimental mind. The Swede, Carl Mossander, boasted of his ignorance of chemical theory and showed exactly how unimportant it was by discovering more rare earths than anybody else by dint of sheer hours spent at the laboratory bench. There is a definite rustle of the anorak about these elements. With the hindsight of established scientific knowledge, it might be easier to crystallize their stories in words than it was to crystallize the elements themselves, but it would quite probably be just as tedious as the original exercise. So I shall not spend time on all of them, but rather single out one or two as representative of the set. The differences between them are slight in any case. They behave in generally similar ways and do similar things. Some of these things are useful. Rare earths are widely, if sparingly, employed in ceramic glazes, fluorescent lamps, television screens, lasers, alloys, and refractory materials. But the matter of choosing which one of them to use in many of these applications is, if not entirely inconsequential, then at least somewhat arbitrary. Not always, however. Occasionally, one of these rare earth elements recommends itself for the job above all the others. If you take a Euro 5 note and hold it under an ultraviolet light, the dull yellow stars that slice through the classical arch on the front face of the note suddenly glow an intense red. On the reverse, a three-tiered Roman bridge appears to float in a ghostly greenish light above a river of indigo. This light comes from special inks incorporated into the notes in order to make them difficult to counterfeit, which are excited to luminescence by the powerful ultraviolet irradiation. The exact nature of the chemical compounds used is, of course, kept secret by the European banks. However, in 2002, just months after the euro went into circulation, a pair of Dutch chemists decided to amuse themselves by performing an unusual spectroscopic analysis. Frigg Suyver and Andreas Meyrink at the University of Utrecht shone ultraviolet light onto euro notes and recorded the exact color tones of visible light they emitted as a result. From this, they were able to declare that the red light was due to ions of the rare earth element europium, bound in a complex with two acetone-like molecules. They were less sure about the other colors, but speculated that the green might be due to even more elaborate ions involving europium, combined with strontium, gallium, and sulfur, and the blue to a europium complex with barium and aluminium oxides. They suspended their inquiries at this point, warning others who might be tempted to follow them that any further investigation into what causes the luminescence of euro notes would constitute a violation of the law. But the unraveling of this little secret hardly gets to the nub of the matter. What we would really like to know is how it came to be decided that, of all the many inks that performed this trick, it should be inks based on europium that were chosen. It was, after all, a political decision in the end that a banknote issued in the name of European unity should have its mission slyly reinforced by impregnation with a chemical element named in celebration of the very same idea. Europium metal is as soft as lead and must be stored under oil to stop it bursting into flame in air. It is the most reactive of the rare earths, and because of its urge to bind strongly to other elements, it was among the last of them to be discovered. In Art Nouveau Paris, Eugène Anatole de Marsais began to suspect that samples he had acquired of samarium and gadolinium, the future europium's next-door neighbors in the periodic table, discovered a decade or so before, might not be pure. De Marsais was a gaunt, severe-looking man whose chief glory was his florid moustache. He spent his early career working in the laboratory of a noted Paris perfumer, but soon went freelance and acquired renown as a spectroscopist. He could read the spectrum of a substance like the score of an opera, according to a contemporary. The Curies would soon come to him to confirm their discovery of the elements polonium and radium. Beginning in 1896, de Marsais prepared salts from his samarium and gadolinium samples and, through the exhaustive process of separation by crystallization, was able to isolate a new salt that was progressively richer in an unidentified substance. By 1901, he had amassed sufficient evidence to confirm his suspicion that this was a new element. De Marsais named his element for the entire continent of Europe, but he seems to have left no account of why he did so. His choice ran conspicuously against a contemporary trend of naming new elements after nation-states. Not long before, Mossander in Stockholm and various others at the University of Uppsala had seen to it that a clutch of new elements were given names after places in Sweden. Gallium was named for France in 1875. Germanium for Germany in 1886. Freshest of all in the memory of de Marsais was the Curie's discovery of polonium in 1898, in which he had assisted. Perhaps all this nationalistic fervor was reason enough to cast an opposing vote. In the Europe of 1901, prescient souls had long since begun to suspect that nation-states might not be everlasting, with Frenchmen taking the boldest line. Victor Hugo was the first to speak of a United States of Europe in 1848. The Breton philosopher Ernest Renan dared to ask in a famous lecture given in 1882 at the Sorbonne, "What is a nation?" and to imagine that they will be replaced, in all probability, by a European confederation. This cosmopolitan spirit was evident at the Paris Universal Exposition of 1900, when more than 50 million people came to see 40 nations drawn from all the continents exhibiting their wares, including specimens of the newly discovered rare earths. Most European citizens, it has to be said, showed no sign of such ideals, and nationalism, having successfully delivered the unified new states of Italy and Germany, set off on a downward spiral based less on liberal high-mindedness and more on ethnic and linguistic tribalism. Before long, it seemed that any group of self-asserting Ruritanians, to use the historian Eric Hobsbawm's term, might suddenly decide to call themselves a nation. For de Marsais, a well-traveled autodidact accustomed to forming his own ideas, it must have been easy to resist the prevailing drift of nationalism and nail his colors to the mast through his chemical discovery. He would have surely welcomed the advent of the European Union, and rejoiced to see his metal become part of its economic fabric. The European Central Bank seems incapable of spreading this joy, however. It willfully misunderstands my request to know who fought for europium and drearily asks for my understanding that, for security reasons, we cannot comment on the chemical components of the euro banknote security features. I know what the chemical components are. What I want to know is who was the wag in the Brussels bureaucracy who made sure it was europium that was used? The bank requires its money to incorporate these security features, including raised print, metallic strips, watermarks, and holograms, but does not actually print the stuff itself, and therefore does not specify that europium or any other particular material must be used for the luminescent dyes. So others may have been responsible in any case. However, the leading printers of euro banknotes will tell me nothing either. I reread Seiver and Meyerink's paper and see that it contains a clue. Seeking confirmation of their europium revelation, they contacted the Dutch National Bank and were eventually put in touch with a researcher there. During the course of their conversation, the bank employee accidentally let slip something that jogged a memory in the Utrecht chemists. A few years earlier, he and a colleague visited our laboratory. Meyerink remembers. During his visit, we were able to supply him with a great deal of information about luminescent materials. Not surprisingly, he could not give us much information. So were the Utrecht chemists actually responsible for planting the idea of using europium in the first place? Did they simply stage their analytical discovery in order to lay a false scent? Or did they do it because they couldn't resist claiming their own paternity, as it were, of the europium dyes in the euro? Or alternatively, was it the mysterious visiting bankers who had the brainwave, bowing to fate when they heard that an element called europium was one of those that would be suitable for the job? For now, nobody seems to want to claim this inspired decision as their own. Oerlicht. The girl is naked from the waist up, and from there down she is draped only in the lightest gauze. She is kneeling, with her head cocked to one side, and smiles naughtily out from beneath her brunette curls. In her right hand, she appears to hold a dazzling halo of white light, at the center of which an even brighter light shines out. Appears, because the light has no obvious source or connection. It is pure illumination. She grips the stem of a large sunflower for support, and is framed by vigorous tendrils of other growth. Set to one side in front of the plane of the picture, it would be anachronistic within it, is a standard gas street lamp. The message becomes clear. This Vestal Virgin is holding forth the promise of a new light, like the light of the sun, that will brighten the world. Giovanni Mattolini's 1895 poster advertised the improved gas lighting of the Brevetto Aua Company of Rome. Guardarsi dalle contraffazioni. Beware of imitations. It was one of hundreds of similar images that appeared in cities across Europe and America around the turn of the century. Full-color illustrated posters were the latest fashion in advertising, and no field of commerce was more assiduous in seeking the public's favor than the fast-expanding domestic lighting industry, where gas and electricity vied ceaselessly with rival innovations. The breakthrough that enabled gas to maintain its advantage over the newfangled electric lighting for a little longer during the closing years of the 19th century was made by Karl Auer, later the Baron von Welsbach, a Viennese who had completed his studies in Heidelberg with Robert Bunsen, long a guru of European chemists. On his arrival in Heidelberg in 1880, Auer showed the great man a modest collection of rare earth mineral specimens that he had amassed, and Bunsen set him to work analyzing them, laughing off Auer's protests that the quantities were insufficient. This project set the course of his career, and the rare earths would make his fortune. Auer's Annus Mirabilis came in 1885 back in Vienna, when he succeeded in separating the supposed element didymium into two true elements, which were duly named praseodymium and neodymium. Their green and pink compounds make them attractive for use in ceramic wares and in tinted glass for protective eyewear. Auer was not content merely to add to the number of the rare earths. In his Heidelberg days, he had marveled at Bunsen's already famous burner, with its tunable flame that could be adjusted to simmer or roast. He had noticed how, when turned up high, the Bunsen burner flame would cause his rare earth ores to glow brightly with their own light. He began to explore this phenomenon with different combinations of metal oxides. It was well known that a flame set against a piece of lime, calcium oxide, will produce the incandescence known as limelight. Auer's investigation included the oxides of magnesium and beryllium, both closely related to lime, as well as those of his rare earths and other elements. Gas lighting was well established in streets and homes by the mid-19th century, but the light it shed was limited by the luminosity of the flame it produced, which depended in turn on the mixture of hydrocarbons being burnt. Candles and oil lamps gave a brighter light than gas, but only gas could be supplied continuously. Auer believed that a lamp design, in which his rare earth oxides were positioned close to the gas flame, might yield a brighter light. Over a period of several years, he soaked sleeves of cotton mesh in different mixtures of rare earth and other salts. Once dried, these sleeves, or mantles, now stiff with encrusted oxide, were placed around the flame, which burnt away the fabric to leave a brittle lace of refractory oxide. This would then glow brightly in the heat of the flame. Little was known about the properties of many of the oxides, and still less about how they behaved in combination, so there was no way of predicting which composition would produce a white incandescence. Auer first patented a gas light with a mantle made of a mixture of magnesium, lanthanum, and yttrium oxides in 1885, but its fragility and sickly green light meant that it remained unpopular. However, by 1891, he found that thorium and cerium oxides, mixed in the proportions of 99:1, gave a satisfactory white light. Thorium is not a rare earth, but is the heavier and, unknown then, radioactive cousin of cerium. Mantles made of this material were more sturdy and quickly caught on. Unusually for a scientist, Auer was an astute businessman, and his name soon became more widely known even than Bunsen's. For while the Bunsen burner had its place in the laboratory, the bright new Auerlicht, as it was known, was of utility to all, and was rapidly distributed across a grateful continent by various Auer companies. Some 90,000 Auer mantles were sold in Vienna and Budapest alone in 1892. 20 years later, annual production stood at around 300 million units. It can have done no harm to the inventor's prospects that Auer, a variant of the prefix Ur, is an archaic German word for the dawn. At the exact moment when the first of Auer's bright gas lamps was lit outside the Opern Café in Vienna, on the 4th of November 1891, Auer's countryman Gustav Mahler, no stranger to the place, was composing a song that would be incorporated into his second symphony called Urlicht, Primordial Light. Auer clearly acquired a taste for appending his name to his inventions. He followed up the success of the gas mantle with an osmium electric filament, the Auer Oslite. Even as he perfected his gas mantle, Auer was hedging his technological bets by experimenting with materials for the electric lamps that he had already suspected might one day replace them. In 1903, he patented an alloy of cerium and iron. He called it Auer Metal No. 1. That produced sparks when struck. Flints of this material are still used in cigarette lighters today. Everything Auer touched seemed to turn to light. No wonder that on the occasion of his ennoblement, he chose for his coat of arms the motto, Plus Lucis, more light. Cerium is the most abundant of the rare earths, and is more plentiful than many familiar elements such as copper. It seems destined to remain widespread if largely unappreciated in our lives. The metal is used to improve the performance of cast irons, steels, and aluminium alloys. Known as jeweler's rouge, its powdered oxide is a fine abrasive used to polish gemstones and glass. In the 19th century, it was recognized that cerium salts were anti-emetic, and they were also incorporated into cough tinctures, antibacterial treatments against burns and tuberculosis. Conveniently for medicines, these salts also possess a characteristic sweet taste. More recently, there has been excitement at the discovery that cerium oxide added to diesel fuel greatly improves its combustion efficiency, and it is still used in illumination to brighten the powerful lights used on film sets.